Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. It claims 44,000 lives each year, more than 500 in Maryland. In this state, roughly half of suicides are committed by firearms. As suicide rates approach a 30-year high, researchers are working to pinpoint the causes of suicide attempts and determine how to prevent access to the most lethal means of completing suicide, firearms. Dr. Paul Nestat is a psychiatrist and a postdoctoral fellow in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School's Psychiatric Epidemiology Training Program. He's also lead author of a study published this month in the American Journal of Public Health titled Urban-Rural Differences in Suicide in the State of Maryland, The Role of Firearms. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why take the approach of comparing suicide rates in rural versus urban areas?
Well, nationally, we've known that the rural rates of suicide are much higher than the urban rates, and they've been climbing higher as well. So as the total suicide rates climbed in this country since 2001, the rural rates have climbed faster and have always been higher. And there's been a lot of thoughts about why that might be. It's a very rich topic of research. Maybe there's more stigma against getting health in rural areas. Maybe there's less access to health, to mental health care in rural areas. Or maybe there's something beyond the cultural and something more practical like access to firearms. Now, in suicide research nationwide, it's been widely recognized that access to firearms in an area leads to a higher suicide rate, not just a firearm suicide rate, but suicide in general, because there's just a quicker, easier, lethal way to end your life.
How much more lethal?
Well, firearms in a suicide attempt have about an 85% lethality rate. And you can compare that to something like overdosing, which is another very common method, which has about a 2% fatality rate because there's so many ways to save the person. It takes longer. Because it's more lethal, an attempt becomes a completion a lot more easily.
With a firearm.
With a firearm.
So what was your hypothesis then when you decided to do a study?
Well, we wanted to see if taking firearms out of the equation alone would be enough to eliminate the difference between urban and rural suicides, which would then imply that rural suicides owe their higher rate to firearms primarily, aside from any other cultural or environmental component that might have gone into it.
What'd you find?
Well, we did find that when we took firearms out of the equation, that's exactly what happened. So we took all 6,000 suicides in Maryland over the past 13 years. And we divided them into ones that had died by firearm and ones that had died by any other means. About half of the suicides were firearm suicides, which is consistent with the national rates. And we found that, sure enough, the rural suicides, which has a higher rate of 13 per 100,000 in Maryland, was a higher rate than the urban suicides, which were about 10 per 100,000 in Maryland. But specifically in rural areas, 61% of people were using guns, and in urban areas, only 46% of people were using guns to end their lives. When we looked at just non-firearm suicides, there was no difference between rural and urban suicide rates. They were the same. It was only the firearm suicide rates that drove rural rates higher. And in fact, when we further divided by sex, which is somewhat correlated with the choice of lethal means when you're attempting suicide, women tend to overdose and men tend to use guns. We found that women actually, regardless of means, were much more likely to end their lives if they lived in an urban environment. The female suicide rate was predominantly urban. And that's useful policy-wise because that means that interventions that are meant to prevent suicide might be targeted more at urban areas for female suicide, whereas the trend has been to focus more and more on rural areas.
Most people would consider Maryland fairly urbanized compared to really rural states. For the study, how did you determine whether an area was rural or urban?
Well, the USDA actually releases characterizations of rurality. It's an odd term, but it has to do with population density and things like that. So there's several gradations of how rural versus urban a county is. So the most urban counties they call, you know, category 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. After you cross over into category 6 on that scale, you become what's known as a rural county. Now, Maryland's rural counties, which are type 6 as opposed to type 7 or 8 or 9, are the most characteristic rural counties that you would see throughout the country. If you look at the United States population living in rural counties, the vast majority of them are living in type 6 counties. It's the most representative rural county, and that's the only type of rural county we have here. We don't have the types of large swaths of farmland you'd see in the Midwest, but we have rural land.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with psychiatrist Dr. Paul Nestat of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School about his research into suicides in Maryland involving guns. You looked at where someone was resident and the means by which they died, but not income, marital status, employment. Why not consider those factors?
It is very common in large epidemiologic studies to try to control for everything that might affect your outcome. So as I mentioned earlier, there are lots of theories of other things that might drive a suicide rate to be higher in rural areas. The number one is access to mental health care, which we did not control for. And the reason we didn't is actually one of the reasons that we used Maryland. So Maryland, being a wealthy state, actually does not have the shortages of mental health care in rural areas compared to urban that other states have. There's a measure of this that we were able to use to quantify the statistical difference between those different areas. So we didn't control for that. But we also didn't control for more common things like unemployment rates or alcohol use rates, things that would contribute to suicide, largely because there's a tendency in this sort of research to over-control, to try to factor everything into your model. And what that ends up doing is making your results very difficult to interpret. We wanted to get a really clear sense of, aside from anything else happening, ignoring anything else happening, like the economy or the unemployment rate or the alcohol use rate or whatever, whether just simply taking guns out of the equation, just looking at all the non-gun suicides in urban and rural areas, which are affected by unemployment and all those other sort of things, if taking guns out alone eliminated the difference, and it did. If we had found that it didn't, we might have to do secondary analyses and sensitivity analyses, controlling for lots of other things. But put very simply, people that didn't use guns had no increased rural rates of suicide. It became moot whether you were in an urban or rural area.
So who is at greatest risk of suicide involving firearm?
Well, largely those numbers parallel the general suicide numbers because the firearms are driving the general suicide numbers. So that means that the people that are most at risk are men, particularly white men. It's about triple the suicide rate in whites versus African Americans, similarly in men versus women. There are certain age groups that are at higher risk, mostly around your 50s. And then people are at risk for various social reasons, like if they've just undergone a divorce, recent unemployment, homelessness is a risk, chronic pain is a risk, substance abuse is maybe one of the largest risks alongside major depressive disorder.
So men in rural areas facing the same types of pressure?
Yes.
That is making them more likely to attempt suicide, or do they just have greater access to firearms?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. So men, although they do complete suicide at a much higher rate than women, they attempt at a much lower rate. Women attempt suicide much more commonly than men do, but because they're using much less lethal means, like overdosing or sometimes hanging in general, they complete suicide much less often, which is a further illustration of the importance of how you attempt.
Well, there's a common belief that if someone wants to die by suicide, you can't stop them.
That's actually a really dangerous myth, and one that I think leads to a lot of loss of life. The idea that if someone's made up their mind that they want to end their life, then no matter what you do, they're going to do it. If they don't have a gun, they'll find a bridge. If they are locked up in the hospital, they'll wait till they're released. This leads to people dying because research has shown that's not the case. Two really good studies I like, really the two biggest studies of this, were done, one in San Francisco and one in London. In San Francisco, they looked at 515 people that had made attempts to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, which is a popular spot for this, who had been physically restrained, like they'd been caught in the scaffolding or they'd been picked up by the police by the collar, you know. So they had a real intention of dying. This wasn't a superficial wrist cut or something. They followed those people, those 515 people, for a mean of 27 years, so for a long time. And during that time, very few, about 5 or 10%, ever went on to attempt suicide again or to die by suicide. And a similar study was done in London where they followed 100 people that had jumped in front of the London Underground Tube but had not been killed because they'd fallen under the tracks. And once again, only about 5 or 10% of them ever went on to attempt to complete suicide, which illustrates the fact that if you make a serious suicide attempt, that doesn't mean you're doomed to keep trying until you die. But rather, if you make an attempt and it does not result in your death, you'll probably go to treatment, and that treatment will probably work. because in 80% of cases, this is due to major depressive disorder, which is an eminently treatable disease. That's what I do for a living, is treat that disease. If people recognize that there's a treatable disease, and if they are able to hold someone back from the ledge, so to speak, just long enough to get treatment, or even for the impulse to pass, then they've saved that life. They haven't just delayed a death.
So what does this research tell you about methods of reducing suicides by firearm?
Locking up a gun is a really important first step. Kids that get access to their parents' firearms are the most affected in terms of suicide completion by these firearms being around. So if these guns were locked up, kids couldn't access them. Similarly, adults that don't have access to that gun key, so to speak. There are other things. There are more complicated policy things. Like, for instance, in Maryland, the laws regarding transferring a firearm during an emergency situation are very murky. So if someone's at risk of suicide and their doctor says, you got to get your gun out of the house, it can be illegal for them to give that gun to a friend or a neighbor, because that neighbor would then not have had a background check. And this is complicated, and there's important things on both sides. But in emergencies like suicide or acute domestic violence, I think is another one to think about, there should be clearer ways for guns to be transferred. There are also larger things regarding permits to purchase and larger scale gun policies, but they're very politically hot and difficult to get into without starting a fight sometimes.
Background checks?
Well, there's actually been some good recent studies on which specific policies help with suicide and homicide rates. And those studies have found that background checks, largely because they're not easily enforced, don't help as much as something like a waiting period or having to get a permit to get the firearm. Those things tend to allow people a cooling off period while they wait for the gun. If suicide is relatively impulsive, as I'm saying, then having to wait a few days between deciding you want to get this gun and end your life and then actually getting the gun gives you a few days to change your mind, and that actually does happen. That's what we see happening.
I appreciate you walking us through this. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Paul Nestad is a psychiatrist and a postdoctoral fellow in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School's Psychiatric Epidemiology Training Program. He studied the impact of firearms on rural suicide rates. Since we first aired this interview last fall, the state legislature has passed a so-called red flag law. It permits a judge to suspend someone's right to possess a gun for up to 1 year if they're reported for threatening violence against themselves or others. Quick break, and then what can family members do to help relatives at risk of suicide? I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about suicide, which claims more than 40,000 American lives each year, the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., and very much related to firearms. Of all the deaths in the U.S. involving guns, 2 out of 3 of those deaths are suicides. We just spoke with Dr. Paul Nestad about his research comparing suicide deaths in Maryland's urban and rural counties. About 9 out of 10 individuals who die by suicide have experienced mental illness, and so we've invited the National Alliance on Mental Illness Maryland to be part of this conversation. NAMI Maryland is a grassroots organization dedicated to building better lives for individuals and families affected by mental illness. Joining us by phone is Jessica Honke, Policy and Advocacy Director for NAMI Maryland. Welcome to On the Record. Hi.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you for having us today.
Jessica, the suicide rate in rural counties in Maryland is higher than in urban areas. It's being driven up by suicides by men involving firearms. The reasons for this are unclear. It may be because of social isolation, economic disparities. In what ways is NAMI Maryland reaching out to rural communities?
We have 13 affiliates across the state of Maryland. Our programs, many of them are provided by volunteers. They're all free programs. And so we're working on increasing our impact and our spread across the rural areas. I think there are things that we are doing, not only at NAMI Maryland, but policymakers, psychiatrists in the field of mental health in general, the use of telepsychiatry, making sure that insurance companies have an adequate network in a rural area so that folks don't have to wait for an appointment. So at NAMI Maryland, in addition to our programs, we advocate at the state, local, and federal level to increase access to treatment and services.
Jessica, men are four times more likely than women to die in their suicide attempts. How do you reach out to men who may be reluctant to seek help?
There is stigma related to mental illness. It's not thought of as a disease like other physical or somatic diseases, but it is a chronic brain disease. And we work with our partners like Brothers Keeper and other organizations that work with men to share our programs and ensure that they have the peer support. And that's what is very necessary, not only just for men, but individuals with mental illness, regardless of gender, is that they have that peer support so that they don't feel alone and have that sense of hopelessness.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jessica Honke, Policy and Advocacy Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Maryland. We're speaking about suicide prevention, and I'd like to pull into the conversation now the program specialist for NAMI Maryland, Denise Valentine. Denise?
Hi.
Hi. It's nice to speak with you again. You came very close to suicide about 20 years ago. What drove you to that point?
The isolation, the aloneness that I felt. I have been diagnosed with major depression and PTSD. So the severity of my illness drove me to that point.
So how did it play out? I mean, did you realize that you were at risk?
Actually, my story is not unique. I had planned on committing suicide. I had saved up all my pills, and I happened upon a NAMI office, and I started taking advantage of their support program, the NAMI Connection Support Group. I went to support group, and I realized that I was not alone, and I kept going back. And I took advantage of the peer education program, which is a peer-to-peer relapse and recovery education program, and taught me how to recognize my triggers and how to cope with those triggers and not deepen the depression and not become suicidal again. Peer support was an excellent supplement to the treatment that I was receiving.
Denise, why is mental illness such a risk factor for suicide?
One of the reasons mental illness has such an impact on whether or not someone thinks about suicide is that you're part of a vulnerable population. And in addition to that, you have isolation, which is a big thing, and stigma that surrounds mental illness further isolates you. And when a person is isolated and feeling at an all-time low, which is happens often with people with mental illness, then suicidal ideations are more prevalent.
Jessica, what warning signs should people be aware of that may indicate someone's feeling suicidal?
So there are several behaviors that are both damaging and dangerous and therefore should be considered a psychiatric emergency. And so a family member or someone, a loved one that sees these types of warning signs, threats or comments about killing themselves, which also is known as suicidal ideation, can begin with harmless thoughts like, I wish I wasn't here, but can escalate and become overt and more dangerous over time. If you see someone increasing their alcohol and drug use or aggressive behavior increases, also social withdrawal from family, friends, and community or other hobbies and things that they once really took pleasure in participating in, if there are dramatic mood swings, talking, writing, or thinking about death, and often there's some type of possible impulsive or reckless behavior.
How do you suggest that family and friends raise these points or ask about it?
Obviously, it can be very frightening and intimidating when you have a loved one that reveals or shows a sign of suicidal thoughts. Family and friends should ensure that they are able to calmly ask simple and direct questions, such as, can I help you call your psychiatrist, rather than, would you rather I call your psychiatrist? They should talk openly and not be afraid to ask questions Are you having thoughts of suicide? Importantly, do you have a plan for how you would kill yourself? Those are indicators, if the answers are yes, that 911 should be called. If there are multiple people, have one person speak at a time. Don't argue or raise your voice. No blaming. And certainly, we have a Maryland crisis line here. It's 1-800-422-0009, and that's the Maryland crisis hotline. Also, reassuring your loved one that you're concerned about them for his or her well-being and encouraging them to lean on you for support without judgment, I think, is most important.
Everything you just said is important, but I want to underscore that it is valuable to specifically ask someone, are you planning suicide? Do you have a plan?
Yes.
Many people would think, oh my gosh, that will push them into it.
Well, I think that because it becomes an immediate crisis situation, finding out if you can, are you having suicidal thoughts? And if the answer is yes, do you have a plan for how you would kill yourself so that you know the extent of the seriousness and that you can immediately call 911 to get them help or the crisis line?
Maryland sees about 500 suicides each year, roughly half of them committed by firearms. What can family members do when they're concerned about a loved one who has access to guns?
I think that it is important to make sure that your loved one does not have access to those firearms. So removing firearms from the home or their home is an important step. You want to make sure that if they're looking around to buy or steal or borrow a tool that they need to contemplate or complete suicide, such as firearms or prescription medication, you want to make sure that that's well monitored or remove them from the home. And really, if you're unsure if there is a firearm involved, certainly 911 and a crisis line, as well as speaking to a licensed mental health professional, they can help you assess what that risk is if there is a gun in the home.
The crisis line you've referred to a few times, what is that number?
The Maryland crisis line is 1-800-422-0009.
1-800-422-0009. Denise, just one last question. I wanted to get your thoughts about the best way for a friend or family member to speak up if they're seeing what they think is a risk factor.
Jessica made an excellent point. Find out if there is a plan and the time frame that the plan is going to be implemented so that you would be aware of when you need to call the crisis line for them. When you get better and you've had time to recover, you realize that the person loved you a whole lot. And that there was a total act of love, and they wanted your presence in their lives.
Thank you both for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Jessica Honke is the Policy and Advocacy Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Maryland. Denise Valentine is NAMI Maryland's program specialist. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to information about NAMI Maryland's classes and events and to the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School study of rural suicides. The Maryland Crisis Hotline number is 1-800-422-0009. Again, 1-800-422-0009. We've got that on the website, too. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. It claims 44,000 lives each year, more than 500 in Maryland. In this state, roughly half of suicides are committed by firearms. As suicide rates approach a 30-year high, researchers are working to pinpoint the causes of suicide attempts and determine how to prevent access to the most lethal means of completing suicide, firearms. Dr. Paul Nestat is a psychiatrist and a postdoctoral fellow in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School's Psychiatric Epidemiology Training Program. He's also lead author of a study published this month in the American Journal of Public Health titled Urban-Rural Differences in Suicide in the State of Maryland, The Role of Firearms. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why take the approach of comparing suicide rates in rural versus urban areas?
Well, nationally, we've known that the rural rates of suicide are much higher than the urban rates, and they've been climbing higher as well. So as the total suicide rates climbed in this country since 2001, the rural rates have climbed faster and have always been higher. And there's been a lot of thoughts about why that might be. It's a very rich topic of research. Maybe there's more stigma against getting health in rural areas. Maybe there's less access to health, to mental health care in rural areas. Or maybe there's something beyond the cultural and something more practical, like access to firearms. Now, in suicide research nationwide, it's been widely recognized that access to firearms in an area leads to a higher suicide rate, not just a firearm suicide rate, but suicide in general, because there's just a quicker, easier, lethal way to end your life.
How much more lethal?
Well, firearms in a suicide attempt have about an 85% lethality rate. And you can compare that to something like overdosing, which is another very common method, which has about a 2% fatality rate because there's so many ways to save the person. It takes longer. Because it's more lethal, an attempt becomes a completion a lot more easily.
With a firearm?
With a firearm.
So what was your hypothesis then when you decided to do a study?
Well, we wanted to see if taking firearms out of the equation alone would be enough to eliminate the difference between urban and rural suicides, which would then imply that rural suicides owe their higher rate to firearms primarily, aside from any other cultural or environmental component that might have gone into it.
What did you find?
Well, we did find that when we took firearms out of the equation, that's exactly what happened. So we took all 6,000 suicides in Maryland over the past 13 years. And we divided them into ones that had died by firearm and ones that had died by any other means. About half of the suicides were firearm suicides, which is consistent with the national rates. And we found that, sure enough, the rural suicides, which has a higher rate of about 13 per 100,000 in Maryland, was a higher rate than the urban suicides, which were about 10 per 100,000 in Maryland. But specifically in rural areas, 61% of people were using guns, and in urban areas, only 46% of people were using guns to end their lives. When we looked at just non-firearm suicides, there was no difference between rural and urban suicide rates. They were the same. It was only the firearm suicide rates that drove rural rates higher. And in fact, when we further divided by sex, which is somewhat correlated with the choice of lethal means when you're attempting suicide, women tend to overdose and men tend to use guns. We found that women actually, regardless of means, were much more likely to end their lives if they lived in an urban environment. The female suicide rate was predominantly urban. And that's useful policy-wise because that means that interventions that are meant to prevent suicide might be targeted more at urban areas for female suicide, whereas the trend has been to focus more and more on rural areas.
Most people would consider Maryland fairly urbanized compared to really rural states. For the study, how did you determine whether an area was rural or urban?
Well, the USDA actually releases characterizations of rurality. It's an odd term, but it has to do with population density and things like that. So there's several gradations of how rural versus urban a county is. So the most urban counties they call, you know, category 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. After you cross over into category 6 on that scale, you become what's known as a rural county. Now, Maryland's rural counties, which are type 6 as opposed to type 7 or 8 or 9, are the most characteristic rural counties that you would see throughout the country. If you look at the United States population living in rural counties, the vast majority of them are living in type 6 counties. It's the most representative rural county, and that's the only type of rural county we have here. We don't have the types of large swaths of farmland you'd see in the Midwest, but we have rural land.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with psychiatrist Dr. Paul Nestat of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School about his research into suicides in Maryland involving guns. you looked at where someone was resident and the means by which they died, but not income, marital status, employment. Why not consider those factors?
It is very common in large epidemiologic studies to try to control for everything that might affect your outcome. So as I mentioned earlier, there are lots of theories of other things that might drive a suicide rate to be higher in rural areas. The number one is access to mental health care, which we did not control for. And the reason we didn't is actually one of the reasons that we used Maryland. So Maryland, being a wealthy state, actually does not have the shortages of mental health care in rural areas compared to urban that other states have. There's a measure of this that we were able to use to quantify the statistical difference between those different areas. So we didn't control for that. But we also didn't control for more common things like unemployment rates or alcohol use rates, things that would contribute to suicide, largely because there's a tendency in this sort of research to over-control, to try to factor everything into your model. And what that ends up doing is making your results very difficult to interpret. We wanted to get a really clear sense of, aside from anything else happening, ignoring anything else happening, like the economy or the unemployment rate or the alcohol use rate or whatever, whether just simply taking guns out of the equation, just looking at all the non-gun suicides in urban and rural areas, which are affected by unemployment and all those other sort of things, if taking guns out alone eliminated the difference, and it did. If we had found that it didn't, we might have to do secondary analyses and sensitivity analyses, controlling for lots of other things. But put very simply, people that didn't use guns had no increased rural rates of suicide. It became moot whether you were in an urban or rural area.
So who is at greatest risk of suicide involving firearm?
Well, largely those numbers parallel the general suicide numbers because the firearms are driving the general suicide numbers. So that means that the people that are most at risk are men, particularly white men. It's about triple the suicide rate in whites versus African Americans, similarly in men versus women. There are certain age groups that are at higher risk, mostly around your 50s. And then people are at risk for various social reasons, like if they've just undergone a divorce, recent unemployment, homelessness is a risk, chronic pain is a risk, substance abuse is maybe one of the largest risks alongside major depressive disorder.
So men in rural areas facing the same types of pressure?
Yes.
That is making them more likely to attempt suicide, or do they just have greater access to firearms?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. So men, although they do complete suicide at a much higher rate than women, they attempt at a much lower rate. Women attempt suicide much more commonly than men do, but because they're using much less lethal means, like overdosing or sometimes hanging in general, they complete suicide much less often, which is a further illustration of the importance of how you attempt.
Well, there's a common belief that if someone wants to die by suicide, you can't stop them.
That's actually a really dangerous myth, and one that I think leads to a lot of loss of life. The idea that if someone's made up their mind that they want to end their life, then no matter what you do, they're going to do it. If they don't have a gun, they'll find a bridge. If they are locked up in the hospital, they'll wait till they're released. This leads to people dying because research has shown that's not the case. Two really good studies I like, really the two biggest studies of this, were done, one in San Francisco and one in London. In San Francisco, they looked at 515 people that had made attempts to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, which is a popular spot for this, who had been physically restrained, like they'd been caught in the scaffolding or they'd been picked up by the police by the collar, you know. So they had a real intention of dying. This wasn't a superficial wrist cut or something. They followed those people, those 515 people, for a mean of 27 years, so for a long time. And during that time, very few, about 5 or 10%, ever went on to attempt suicide again or to die by suicide. And a similar study was done in London where they followed 100 people that had jumped in front of the London Underground Tube but had not been killed because they'd fallen under the tracks. And once again, only about 5 or 10% of them ever went on to attempt to complete suicide, which illustrates the fact that if you make a serious suicide attempt, that doesn't mean you're doomed to keep trying until you die. But rather, if you make an attempt and it does not result in your death, you'll probably go to treatment, and that treatment will probably work. Because in 80% of cases, this is due to major depressive disorder, which is an eminently treatable disease. That's what I do for a living, is treat that disease. If people recognize that this is a treatable disease, and if they are able to hold someone back from the ledge, so to speak, just long enough to get treatment, or even for the impulse to pass, then they've saved that life. They haven't just delayed a death.
So what does this research tell you about methods of reducing suicides by firearm?
Locking up a gun is a really important first step. Kids that get access to their parents' firearms are the most affected in terms of suicide completion by these firearms being around. So if these guns were locked up, kids couldn't access them. Similarly, adults that don't have access to that gun key, so to speak. There are other things. There are more complicated policy things. Like, for instance, in Maryland, the laws regarding transferring a firearm during an emergency situation are very murky. So if someone's at risk of suicide and their doctor says, you got to get your gun out of the house, it can be illegal for them to give that gun to a friend or a neighbor because that neighbor would then not have had a background check. And this is complicated, and there's important things on both sides. But in emergencies like suicide or acute domestic violence, I think is another one to think about, there should be clearer ways for guns to be transferred. There are also larger things regarding permits to purchase and larger scale gun policies, but they're very politically hot and difficult to get into without starting a fight sometimes.
Background checks?
Well, there's actually been some good recent studies on which specific policies help with suicide and homicide rates. And those studies have found that background checks, largely because they're not easily enforced, don't help as much as something like a waiting period or having to get a permit to get the firearm. Those things tend to allow people a cooling off period while they wait for the gun. If suicide is relatively impulsive, as I'm saying, then having to wait a few days between deciding you want to get this gun and end your life and then actually getting the gun gives you a few days to change your mind, and that actually does happen. That's what we see happening.
I appreciate you walking us through this. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Paul Nestad is a psychiatrist and a postdoctoral fellow in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School's Psychiatric Epidemiology Training Program. He studied the impact of firearms on rural suicide rates. Since we first aired this interview last fall, the state legislature has passed a so-called red flag law. It permits a judge to suspend someone's right to possess a gun for up to 1 year if they're reported for threatening violence against themselves or others. Quick break, and then what can family members do to help relatives at risk of suicide? I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about suicide, which claims more than 40,000 American lives each year, the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., and very much related to firearms. Of all the deaths in the U.S. involving guns, 2 out of 3 of those deaths are suicides. We just spoke with Dr. Paul Nestad about his research comparing suicide deaths in Maryland's urban and rural counties. About 9 out of 10 individuals who die by suicide have experienced mental illness, and so we've invited the National Alliance on Mental Illness Maryland to be part of this conversation. NAMI Maryland is a grassroots organization dedicated to building better lives for individuals and families affected by mental illness. Joining us by phone is Jessica Honke, Policy and Advocacy Director for NAMI Maryland. Welcome to On the Record. Hi.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you for having us today.
Jessica, the suicide rate in rural counties in Maryland is higher than in urban areas. It's being driven up by suicides by men involving firearms. The reasons for this are unclear. It may be because of social isolation, economic disparities. In what ways is NAMI Maryland reaching out to rural communities?
We have 13 affiliates across the state of Maryland. Our programs, many of them are provided by volunteers. They're all free programs. And so we're working on increasing our impact and our spread across the rural areas. I think there are things that we are doing, not only at NAMI Maryland, but policymakers, psychiatrists in the field of mental health in general, the use of telepsychiatry, making sure that insurance companies have an adequate network in a rural area so that folks don't have to wait for an appointment. So at NAMI Maryland, in addition to our programs, we advocate at the state, local, and federal level to increase access to treatment and services.
Jessica, men are 4 times more likely than women to die in their suicide attempts. How do you reach out to men who may be reluctant to seek help?
There is stigma related to mental illness. It's not thought of as a disease like other physical or somatic diseases, but it is a chronic brain disease. And we work with our partners like Brothers Keeper and other organizations that work with men to share our programs and ensure that they have the peer support. And that's what is very necessary, not only just for men, but individuals with mental illness, regardless of gender, is that they have that peer support so that they don't feel alone and have that sense of hopelessness.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jessica Honke, Policy and Advocacy Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Maryland. We're speaking about suicide prevention, and I'd like to pull into the conversation now the program specialist for NAMI Maryland, Denise Valentine. Denise?
Hi.
Hi. It's nice to speak with you again. You came very close to suicide about 20 years ago. What drove you to that point?
The isolation, the aloneness that I felt. I have been diagnosed with major depression and PTSD. So the severity of my illness drove me to that point.
So how did it play out? I mean, did you realize that you were at risk?
Actually, my story is not unique. I had planned on committing suicide. I had saved up all my pills. And I happened upon a NAMI office, and I started taking advantage of their support program, the NAMI Connection Support Group. I went to support group, and I realized that I was not alone. And I kept going back, and I took advantage of their peer education program, which is a peer-to-peer relapse and recovery education program, and taught me how to recognize my triggers and how to cope with those triggers and not deepen their depression and not become suicidal again. Peer support was an excellent supplement to the treatment that I was receiving.
Denise, why is mental illness such a risk factor for suicide?
One of the reasons mental illness has such an impact on whether or not someone thinks about suicide is that you're part of a vulnerable population, and in addition to that, you have isolation, which is a big thing, and stigma that surrounds mental illness further isolates you. And when a person is isolated and feeling at an all-time low, which is happens often with people with mental illness, then suicidal ideations are more prevalent.
Jessica, what warning signs should people be aware of that may indicate someone's feeling suicidal?
So there are several behaviors that are both damaging and dangerous and therefore should be considered a psychiatric emergency. And so a family member or someone, a loved one that sees these types of warning signs, threats or comments about killing themselves, which also is known as suicidal ideation, can begin with harmless thoughts like, I wish I wasn't here, but can escalate and become overt and more dangerous over time. If you see someone increasing their alcohol and drug use or aggressive behavior increases, also social withdrawal from family, friends, and community or other hobbies and things that they once really took pleasure in participating in. If there are dramatic mood swings, talking, writing, or thinking about death, and often there's some type of possible impulsive or reckless behavior.
How do you suggest that family and friends raise these points or ask about it?
Obviously, it can be very frightening and intimidating when you have a loved one that reveals or shows a sign of suicidal thoughts. Family and friends should ensure that they are able to calmly ask simple and direct questions such as, can I help you? Call your psychiatrist, rather than, would you rather I call your psychiatrist? They should talk openly and not be afraid to ask questions. Are you having thoughts of suicide? Importantly, do you have a plan for how you would kill yourself? Those are indicators, if the answers are yes, that 911 should be called. If there are multiple people, have one person speak at a time. Don't argue or raise your voice. No blaming. And certainly, we have a Maryland crisis line here. It's 1-800-422-0009, and that's the Maryland Crisis Hotline. Also, reassuring your loved one that you're concerned about them for his or her well-being, and encouraging them to lean on you for support without judgment, I think is most important.
Everything you just said is important, but I want to underscore that it is valuable to specifically ask someone, are you planning suicide? Do you have a plan?
Yes.
Many people would think, oh my gosh, that will push them into it.
Well, I think that because it becomes a immediate crisis situation, finding out if you can, are you having suicidal thoughts? And if the answer is yes, do you have a plan for how you would kill yourself so that you know the extent of the seriousness and that you can immediately call 911 to get them help or the crisis line?
Maryland sees about 500 suicides each year, roughly half of them committed by firearms. What can family members do when they're concerned about a loved one who has access to guns?
I think that it is important to make sure that your loved one does not have access to those firearms. So removing firearms from the home or their home is an important step. You want to make sure that if they're looking around to buy or steal or borrow a tool that they need to contemplate or complete suicide, such as firearms or prescription medication, you want to make sure that that's well monitored or remove them from the home. And really, if you're unsure if there is a firearm involved, certainly 911 and a crisis line, as well as speaking to a licensed mental health professional, they can help you assess what that risk is if there is a gun in the home.
The crisis line you referred to a few times, what is that number?
The Maryland crisis line is 1-800-422-0009.
1-800-422-0009. Denise, just one last question. I wanted to get your thoughts about the best way for a friend or family member to speak up if they're seeing what they think is a risk factor.
Jessica made an excellent point. Find out if there is a plan and the time frame that the plan is going to be implemented so that you would be aware of when you need to call the crisis line for them. When you get better and you've had time to recover, you realize that the person loved you a whole lot, and that it was a total act of love, and they wanted your presence in their lives.
Thank you both for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Jessica Honke is the Policy and Advocacy Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Maryland. Denise Valentine is NAMI Maryland's Program Specialist. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to information about NAMI Maryland's classes and events and to the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School study of rural suicides. The Maryland Crisis Hotline number is 1-800-422-0009. Again, 1-800-422-0009. We've got that on the website, too. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.